Good morning, 7:42 here on the Mighty 690. And it is time to have our weekly chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Crop Agent James Coover and Holly Miner, Extension Agent for Nutrition, Food Safety, and Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so Holly, you're going to kick things off. I see both of you got a little wet coming in, so we still have a little bit of rain coming down, which is always good. So,
yeah, we need the moisture, don't we, James?
Yeah, yeah. This isn't going to amount to much, but, you know, it is what it is. So, Holly, you have a event that we want to make sure that people know about coming up, right?
Right. We have a couple events coming up here in March and the 1st of April. We have Walk Kansas, which is our annual event, which will start in March and go through May. And then right along with that, Walk Kansas, we have the Southwind and the Wildcat District are both pairing together to do a Wild Wind Walk Run, a 5K. You don't have to run. You can walk. For those of us that don't need the knee-jarring experience.
Sure.
But it is April 1st. It starts at 8 o'clock in the morning in Chanute, which is where we started it off last year. We had the first one, and it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of people come out and participate with us. This year, we are going to have it in Chanute and in Pittsburgh, and so we're excited about that. In Chanute, it will be at the Student Union on the NCCC campus, which is 800 West 14th Street. And then in Pittsburgh, it will be at the Farmers Market Pavilion, which is 119 East 11th Street. And both of those events, like I said, will start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that is on April 1st.
So is there any registration for this? How does this all work to kind of get signed up for?
Yeah, so there is a registration. The cost is $25 for adults and $15 for youth. The price includes the walk run event. It also includes the $10 registration fee for Walk Kansas. So if you participate in the walk run, you'll get the Walk Kansas registration for free. That's included in that. And then every participant will receive a t-shirt. And I know our listeners can't see it, but I brought the t-shirt with me so that we could talk about it.
Oh yeah, it's a nice yellow t-shirt.
Yeah, it'll be a different
yellow and purple.
It'll be a different color this year, but the same design, so we're excited about that. And, so we'll have some snacks. We'll have fun. We did some neat little decorations last year, and everybody just got together and enjoyed it. A great time to get together to kind of kick off that Walk Kansas program. And like I said, that's April 1st. And if you have any questions, you can call our office. Our phone number is 620-331-2690. Registration for Walk Kansas and for the Fun Run Walk actually both start on March 1st.
Okay.
So coming up here pretty soon. We'll start those registrations.
So can you go into a little detail on, so this signs you up for Walk Kansas. What exactly is that program?
So Walk Kansas is an 8-week-long program where people can get together either as a team or as an individual. We're challenging businesses and organizations to put together teams to do the Walk Kansas. When Walk Kansas first started over 20 years ago, we were walking from one side of the state to the other. Now there's trails throughout the state that visit historical places within the state, and so it's kind of fun. You can follow along on the map through the program online and see where you're at and what place you're visiting in the state. So it's a great way to become more familiar with Kansas as well as getting out and getting some physical activity.
Okay, so are there, you know, competitions of who kind of able to walk the furthest or are kind of different goals or that sort of thing?
There are. So we do have competition of which team walks the farthest. You can keep track of it on the online platform. And so there's that goes along with it. There's newsletters that come out each week that help us pick foods that are healthier to eat, try to stay healthy, and then talks about different physical activity, drinking water, all those kinds of things that we need to do when we're trying to live that healthy lifestyle. The thing that's new this year, with WAC Kansas is there's a program called Med, Not Meds. So the first med is Mediterranean. Research has shown that the Mediterranean diet is a healthier diet. And so the second week of the program, that Mediterranean diet program starts. The second meds is medicine. So we're trying to eat healthy and not have to take medicine. So that 6-week program that happens during WAC Kansas is free. It's a great program to be able to learn about eating healthier, different things that you can do to make yourself have nutritious foods, but still enjoy the food that you're eating, and maybe make little changes that will have a big effect on your health and your lifestyle throughout your life.
No, that is great, and it's neat to be able to combine a bunch of different things within that program. And if you have a team, can each person kind of like measure how far they walk, and then does that all add together?
It does. So each person counts the number of minutes that they're walking. So if they walk 1 mile, that's considered an hour's worth of walking. And they count those they log them online into that program, and then each team's minutes add up for the total for the team. So.
Okay, and that makes it easy because, you know, it can be kind of tough to measure. You know, you can get a pedometer or maybe the thing on your phone, but those are kind of sometimes hard, and or if you're trying to do a map or something. So I think minutes, that's a pretty easy way to measure things.
And it's things that you know, walking to the mailbox to get the mail if you live a long ways from the mailbox, or if your house is set back off the road if you live in the country, you know, walking around the block, the things that you don't normally do, like walking from one end of the house back and forth. If you're intentionally walking just back and forth in the house, then that would count. But if you're walking from one end of the house and say, oh, it took me a minute to get here, that's probably not what we want to consider. Yeah. That's normal everyday activity. We want to get you out and get you more physically active.
No, when I was in Arkansas, I mean, it took about probably 20 minutes to walk to and from the mailbox. So yeah, if you're, you know, instead of taking the side by side, maybe walk, you know,
or park farther away when you go to the store, you know, park farthest from the door. So you get those few extra steps in and get a little more physical activity. I think, you know, in today's world, we drive almost everywhere, and just having the time to be able to have those few extra steps makes a big difference.
No, that is really good. You know, yesterday, especially with the weather like we're having right now, I mean, I took the advantage just to take the bike to the grocery store instead, just because, you know, it was so nice and to be able to, you know, get outside. So as we start warming up, you know, people have been cooped up. I think this is a good time of year to really have some interest, and it's a great program. So you want to go over the dates real quick and everything for us so we have that?
Right. So April 1st is our fun run walk in Chanute and in Pittsburgh. Starts at 8 o'clock in the morning. You can register on our website, which is a bit.ly/wildwindwalkrun. And if you need more information about that, you can find that on our website, or you can give us a call at 620-331-2690. And we can share that in more detail for you for how to get registered for that event. April 1st, come out and walk with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good deal, Holly. So while you're here, I want to ask you the question, because we've had some discussion here on Open Line about defrosting meat.
Yes.
Specifically hamburger in my case. So you said there's actually 4 different ways to defrost meat?
There are 4 ways to safely defrost food. So the one way is a way that we think pretty easy. If you have a hamburger patty and it's frozen, you can throw it on the grill or whatever and cook it that way from a frozen state into a cooked state. And you always want to temp that, make sure it's 155 degrees or more for at least 15 seconds. And you know that it's cooked through all the way, that way and it's safe to eat. You can thaw in the refrigerator by taking it out of the freezer, putting it in the refrigerator. I like to put ground hamburger in a bowl or some kind of a plastic container so that if it drips, it doesn't drip on anything else in the refrigerator.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So making sure that it's in something that's going to keep that any of those juices from dripping down.
And for, like, say, a pound of hamburger, that's probably going to take a little while. Like, is it going to be 24 hours? Is it going to take longer?
Yeah, it depends on if it's in a big ball or if it's spread out into a tube. How big a round or diameter the tube is will make a determination as to how long it takes for the food on the inside to completely thaw out.
Sure.
Usually about 24 to 48 hours, depending on how hard frozen it was, too. If you take it out of a deep freeze,
oh, yeah,
it's going to be harder than if you take it out of your refrigerator freezer. Yeah, so give a day, a good day at least. If you're browning it, you can thaw it in the cooking process a little bit when you're browning it, too, if you're making, like, sloppy joes or something like that. But so that's two ways, frozen and in the refrigerator. You can thaw it in cold running water. The water should never be above 70 degrees, and it should not be sitting in water. It should be a steady stream of water running over the top of the food. Most foods we want to, if it's like a chicken or a turkey, we want to take it out of the sack and let the water run over it that way. Hamburger, you probably wouldn't want to do that because it's going to wash the hamburger away. But it does need to be running water and not hot water, because what happens is the outside of the food starts to thaw, and then anything above 70 degrees, bacteria grows faster, so the outside will start have bacteria growth on it, and the inside will still be frozen. So while the inside's going to be okay, the outside's going to have a higher amount of bacteria on it, which is where food safety comes into play. So we want to make sure that we're thawing our food quickly and cooking it. The last way is in the microwave, and we want to make sure that when we thaw food in the microwave that we are continuing to cook it and eat it right away. We don't want to start the thawing process in the microwave and then throw it back in the refrigerator, because there are microwaves don't heat evenly, and there's spots where it could be above that 70 degrees and there could be some cooking going on. And if you put it back in the microwave or in the refrigerator, or you're waiting, or you just set it on the counter and think, well, I'll just cook it in a little while, that bacteria growth is going to be at an elevated rate again, and you're going to have more bacteria growth on it, and again increase the risk of a foodborne illness.
Sure.
Due to
that. That's really good to know. Now, from a taste perspective, is there any one which way that you think is better or worse than the others from your experience?
Oh, I don't know. It just, it's you know, you want to make sure, food safety-wise, you want to make sure that things are cooked through. Taste-wise is a preference.
Sure.
If you like it one way, then thaw it that way. But thawing on the countertop is a no-no. Thawing in hot water is a no-no. Leaving it sit in the sink, no-no. We just want you to all be safe. And, you know, it's not fun having the flu. And so we want to try to avoid that, and especially if you're in a high-risk population. So anybody that's elderly, anybody that is under the age of 5, or anybody with a compromised immune system.
Sure. No, that's a great reminder. I don't think I'd really done it in the microwave. Oh, and the other thing in the microwave is, say you get maybe a square package that's frozen, or maybe one of those round packages. Do you want to take it out of that package and maybe put it in a microwave-safe bowl before you put it in the microwave? What's the best thought on that?
Yeah, I would take it out of the plastic wrap and put it in the microwave. And I would start it and check it a little bit. A lot of times the outside edges will start to cook and the inside won't be cooking as much. So, you know, you're trying to thaw it. You're not trying to cook it in the microwave, unless cooking it in the microwave is what you're trying to do. But do it at short amounts so that you can check it to see how it's doing, because I don't know, taste preference wise, I don't really like food that, you know, meat that's cooked in the microwave. It has a different texture to it. And
yeah, when it beeped at me and I flipped it over to like once in the middle of it, and so it worked out decently when that. But yeah, I know some people are like, yeah, they don't like the way the microwave tastes. Speaking of microwaves, another question I had was, sometimes, you know, people get the food to a doggy bag or like a, you know, a to-go box from a restaurant. And they put it in, you know, that styrofoam box, and then they might take it to work or whatever. I've seen some people heat those up just in the styrofoam in the microwave. Are there any thoughts on that? Is that a bad idea?
Well, if the food has any kind of grease in it, it's going to melt that plastic, that styrofoam, when it heats. That oil will melt that. So a microwave-safe dish is going to probably be your best option. We want to try to avoid any of those chemicals that might be in those plastic containers and having that leach into the food when it's heated. So a microwave-safe dish is going to be your best option to heat it, to not melt the plastic and to not get stuff on your food that you probably don't want in your food.
Sure. And I know a lot of people prefer the glass because even though some of those plastic dishes say they're microwave safe, they sometimes do weird, you know, funny things.
Yeah. If you put a dish in the microwave and it's hot when it comes out, it's not a microwave safe dish.
That's a really good point there. All right. Anything else that you want to share as we kind of wrap up this segment, Holly?
Nope. Just want to invite everybody to come out to the Fun Run on April 1st in Chanute and in Pittsburgh.
Okay. Well, I always appreciate you being here to answer all our questions because, you know, they always come up. So they really do. Hey, coming up, we do have a look at the news at 8 o'clock right after Fox News. We'll be checking our local news. 64 degrees right now in Coffeyville as we head up to a very warm lower 70s for southeast Kansas and northeast Oklahoma. We'll be right back right after this. Coming up on 810 here on the Mighty 690, we continue our chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. You heard just a few minutes ago, I was talking with Holly Miner, and we also have James Coover in studio to talk about a few things. So good morning, James.
Yeah, good morning.
So we're going to talk about wood ash in the yard and garden.
Yes.
So what is wood ash? Where does it come from? Is it sounds pretty self-explanatory, but who knows? There might be more.
You know, ash from wood.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty easy.
Yeah. So, you know, I actually got a outdoor wood burner, you know, earlier in the fall, and burning all that wood makes a lot of ash.
So is that one of those ones that hooks into your house for heat and like hot water and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a basically a big box outside, and it's hot water that comes into your house.
Yeah,
and heats up your house.
I love that. That's such a cool idea.
And so yeah, it's, you know, it's actually saved almost $200 a month on my electric bill. And so
that's
my house
awesome.
Was all electric.
Oh,
and so
wow.
It's a
yeah.
considerable quantity. So it's environmental,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. And wood is just a fantastic energy source.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the trees that we're cutting down, they're all deadfall trees anyway.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
already dead because you want dry wood. And so, you know, it's. And I kind of like cutting firewood. So.
Well, yeah. It's your good, like, winter workout
yeah,
sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
You're getting that physical activity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, it's true. Holding that chainsaw up. Yeah. Burning wood will leave around 3 to 10% in total weight in ash, and so you know you could burn tons of wood in a season.
Because and that just depends on the different varieties of wood. Because some produce more ash than others, right?
Kind of, yeah. And so some wood can produce more ash, but also it's mostly how that wood was burned.
Oh, okay.
And so you know if you have a hot fire, you have plenty of oxygen, you're gonna have less ash, or basically more concentrated ash. Because, I mean, you know, there's a lot of carbon that can be left over. If it's like a fire pit outside, you end up with a lot of black stuff at the bottom. That's basically carbon that hasn't been fully combusted. So ash, it's mostly a liming material rather than a fertilizer. And so when we're talking about this, we're going to kind of go into this deeper. But it's not very powerful when it comes to amount of nutrients that are in it. There's definitely soil elements and nutrients in it. But for the most part, it's when we're talking about it and using it in a garden or a lawn, this is the liming material. And so most of it is calcium carbonate. It's actually 30% calcium, and most of those calciums are connected into carbonates. So there's lots of other elements. Nearly all of them are plant elements because trees absorb them up, and so that's what's in the ash. I'd say about 3% potassium, 1% phosphorus, magnesium, aluminum, iron, those are all about 1% of the actual ash itself. And so there's like less than 1% of copper and boron and all the other micro metals that trees and all plants absorb. And so, you know, there isn't a very concentrated material when it comes to nutrients, but it is useful. So the reason why, you know, that 30% calcium and that 3% potassium, it doesn't add up to 100%.
Yeah.
Because of all the carbonates that are attached onto it. Carbonates are some sort of oxides that are attached onto those elements. So really, you know, it's a lot of oxygen and carbon, honestly, the other parts of the elements. There is very little nitrogen, pretty much none, because all that nitrogen, when it gets hot, it turns to NO2 or nitrous oxide and gases off in the fire. So no nitrogen when it comes to all that.
Sure.
Honestly.
So you mentioned liming, and I guess what is that and how is ash used for that process?
Yeah. So we say liming, it's basically limestone. That's a misnomer, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the carbonate and the calcium carbonate that limes our soil, or basically it, you know, raises the pH.
Okay.
So the carbonate combines with hydrogen in the soil, which is making it the soil acidic, to form water and carbon dioxide. And so it's the carbonate that's actually doing the business. Pure fine lime, as in, you know, limestone, pure fine ag lime is 100% calcium carbonate. And I mean, for the most part, when we're talking about ag lime, not all of that is going to be usable. Some of those granulars are going to be too big. And so we have something called equivalent calcium carbonate. Basically is how effective that lime material is at, you know, raising pH. And so ash can be somewhere between 10 to 90% equivalent calcium carbonate, because there's all kinds of different kinds of ash. I mean, there's all different ways of making it. So it's very variable material. A general rule of thumb, though, we say 50%. It's 50% of a pure, fine, you know, lime material. And so we say 50% ECC. And that's usually how your calculation is going to work anyways. You're going to be looking at ECC. And so, you know, this high variation, you just kind of have to go with what you've got and then basically make adjustments on your pH later on. So.
Oh, that's great. So normally you're just comparing that 50% with like an actual, if you're buying the ag lime, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so, you know, first off, you should only apply ash or lime, honestly, after a soil test, because you cannot possibly know if your soil needs lime.
And we talk about soil tests all the time, you know, but it's another reason to do it.
Yeah. Me, Wendy, Damon, you know, Jesse, we're all talking about soil tests all the time. You know, and it raises pH. And so pretty much any soil below 6.3, I would say, is something that's a candidate for ash or lime. And so really liming soils above 7. So if you don't know what your soil pH is, you go out there and your soil was already above 7, you could actually be doing the opposite. And so what you could be doing is making your soil so alkaline that you're going to be reducing your plant's ability to absorb nutrients. And so once you start to get to that 7.5 to 8 in pH, your plants are actually going to have a harder time. And you can end up with iron deficiencies and some other problems. So don't ash on your garden or lawn until you know that you need it. And so let's say you've soil tested your garden, you have a pH of 5.8, and you have a buffer pH of 6.7. And so here I'll say your pH tells you if you need lime, your buffer pH tells you how much lime you need when you get your soil test results back. And so in that situation of 5.8, and the buffer pH of 6.7, you'll probably need around 150 pounds of dry ash per 1,000 square feet. And 1,000 square feet is not really all that much.
No.
Honestly, I mean, my garden is probably about 3,000 square feet. And so it takes a lot of ash, honestly. I mean, that's a couple of years of ash for the most time.
Would you want to use like a spreader basically for this to do an even coat of a garden?
Yes. So you want to try to get it as even as possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you kind of got to be careful with this stuff too. So you can use a manure spreader if you have a huge quantity of it or something. I mean, ideally speaking, you could even use a truck spreader if you have that quantity. But, you know, if you're just burning out of your wood pit, you're not going to have that amount. So, you know, you want to till that into the top 6 inches as well. To get that activated throughout there. And that will actually raise the pH to an ideal goal of 6.8. That's our target goal. And so just to give you an idea of like how much ash you actually need, it ends up being quite a bit. This is not going to be a field application unless you have some sort of an industrial quantity of wood ash, which in some places of the country they actually do. And so it's best to apply a little bit less than your total quantity needed because you don't know what the ECC is. So if you, let's say you needed 150 pounds, you probably should do about 100 pounds of ash for that 1,000 square feet and then check your pH later on to make sure that you're getting it to the right level. Also remember that if you're top dressing it, so let's say you want to change your yard pH or a pasture or something, that's only going to react in the top 2 inches. And so that rate basically you cut into a third. And so you're doing like 50 pounds per 1,000 square feet instead. So it'll go a lot farther. But, you know, you got to remember that it's how much soil that you're mixing in changes that calculation. So.
Sure. Well, and so, what? Yeah, go ahead.
So, James, how often do you have to add lime to your soil?
So, generally speaking, about every 8 to 10 years.
Wow.
Okay, so, this isn't something that you need to do every year. So you could save that ash up that you're burning in that outdoor heating unit and then apply it as needed after you have your soil test.
Exactly.
And what would be a good method to store that? What would be the best way?
Really anything, as long as you keep it dry.
That's what I was thinking. I'm thinking moisture.
Yes, yes. And so you can't let rain get into it and get through it and all that because... First of all, it's going to make it lumpy, and it's going to be hard to spread. And second of all, it's actually going to leach some of the nutrients out, too. And so you got to make sure that you're keeping that dry. Put it in barrels. That's what I've got, metal barrels out there, or in your garage. I don't know where you keep your ash, but just somewhere dry.
And about what pH are we really shooting for a garden or a yard?
Really, around here, our target pH is 6.8. And so basically, our subsidic, you know, soils... that are pretty acidic, you really kind of want to get to a slightly higher pH. And so 6.8 is really the perfect target for pretty much all plants. That's what they really like.
What about blueberries, though? If you're growing blueberries, they're going to want some acidic.
And there are some special, like azaleas and blueberries. They like more acidic. So.
And maybe, I think tomatoes like a little more acidic, maybe?
That's actually... Yeah.
Or is that like a misnomer?
A little bit of a myth. And so they talk about, you know... planting tomatoes in a big spot where you burned some wood, like you had a wood pile, you burned it. But really, it's just because tomatoes can deal with it. and also, you're only affecting the top couple of inches.
Okay.
And so you're planting those tomatoes below that because you're a transplant, and then the weeds can't really deal with that because they have to start from a seed. Tomatoes don't prefer it, but they do okay in it, I guess, is how it works.
You don't have to worry about weeds as much then.
Exactly. That's mostly about weed control. Then we're talking about tomatoes.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Now, so what about all the nutrients in ash? Do they count for anything?
Yeah. So ash does have some nutrients. And so actually what we were talking about on break is that the term pot ash actually means ash from a pot. And so back in the old settler days, when they were building their cabins, they had a bunch of wood, they would burn it. They would take all that ash, they would throw it in a big pot and run water through it to make lye. Well, they boiled that lye down and they scraped that pot out, and that black stuff basically from that boiled pot was called pot ash. It was full of potassium. We still call potassium potash, even though it has nothing to do with that process. We just still call it potash. It's potassium chloride from a mine somewhere internationally. So, you know, it's just what we call it. But ash is mostly potassium, around 3%, about 4 pounds per 100 pounds of ash. And so it has some phosphorus, maybe around 2 pounds per 100 pounds, and pretty much every micronutrient that you can imagine in some small quantity. And so if you apply this at a rate of 100 to 150 pounds of ash per 1,000 square feet of garden, you're actually getting pretty close to the right amount of phosphorus, potassium, and all those micronutrients. So it's pretty well balanced, honestly, but if it's used as a liming material, this is not a fertilizer. You can't just spread out there a few handfuls. This is not micro grow or whatever. It won't work very well. It is not nutrient dense, but it really does have literally everything. And so zinc, boron, all the other ones that are kind of a little bit harder to get in other nutrient forms, it has all that. And so... You know, it does have some heavy metals because plants absorb heavy metals.
That's
too.
Interesting.
You know, like lead and mercury and all that. But those quantities are incredibly small.
Sure.
Just like, you know, what plants don't readily absorb a lot of their are heavy metals. And so unless it was grown in some weird place, that wood was grown in a place with a natural or an unnatural contamination.
Sure, and we do have that, you know, in Southeast Kansas. But yes. I know that Jesse was saying, you know, as far as the further, like, the fruit is from the soil, basically, the less it's going to, you know, collect those heavy metals.
Yes.
It's kind of as a rule of thumb.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so it's not really a concern, honestly. If you're applying this in a normal way, you'll never get enough. Soil already has a number of heavy metals in it. It's just not concentrated enough to be a risk.
Yeah.
And plants have a natural ability to filter that out for us, actually. And so they're doing us a favor. There's only, like, one heavy element that plants can't deal with, and that's not something that we really have around here. So
I have another question for you. So when do you apply lime? When should lima be applied after your soil is tested?
That's a good question. And so you can apply lime pretty much any time, honestly. And so whether you do it in the spring or the fall, it doesn't really matter, honestly. And so your application, you kind of want to time it with the weather more than anything else. And so, I mean, really kind of want to do it but when it's not very windy out, because it's ash, it's very fine.
Mm-hmm.
And ideally right before rain.
Yeah.
So yesterday would have been perfect.
Oh, sure.
Honestly, because it was really still there for a bit. Also, high humidity will help keep that ash down as well.
And if for maybe a garden is something we want to till in, or what's the best thing to do?
Yeah. And so if you're liming on a garden, you know, it's best to actually this time of the year, honestly, right before you till in for the first time. And get it down into the soil. Fall is also a very another good time, basically right after the growing season. You kind of know what your pH is, and you can lime then and till it in for next spring. That's also a great time. If you're doing your yard or pasture situation, fall is also another good time, but honestly, it doesn't matter. I mean, the pH is going to react whenever. And so as long as you get it soaked into the soil or mixed into the soil in some way, any time of the year works.
And how long does it take to get a soil test back? So if somebody wanted to treat their garden before growing season, now would be the time they need to test.
Yes, yes. And so it generally, you come to the extension office, get a soil probe, all that. We'll send it off for you. And it takes around a week to 10 days most of the time. And so sometimes those tests take a little bit longer. But usually a week to 10 days is the turnaround time that you can expect.
And those tests are available from any county extension office. You know, anyone in Oklahoma or Arkansas or Missouri, you know.
Pretty much anywhere in the country, go in your extension office. They can help send off a soil test. The most accurate way is taking a soil test, a soil probe, like we've mentioned many times before. And you can borrow those from any extension office. And so when you're working with ash, like I was mentioning before, be careful. I mean, this is a highly alkaline material. It's not toxic. It's not caustic. But it's, you know, it's very fine. It'll get into your lungs. It's very alkaline. It'll dry out your skin. And so just be careful with it and don't apply it on a windy day where it's going to blow back in your face, pretty much.
That's
so.
A good idea on that. All right. Well, that is, you know, really, I think, an interesting topic. I definitely always learn a lot from that.
Yeah.
Anything else on this, or are there anything else you want to hit?
We do have a couple programs coming up, and so most of mine are done, actually. And so now I'm just helping Wendy and the Daven. Wendy's soil or Wendy's Animal Health Day, that'll be on March 1st in Independence, and a Daven's Sheep and Goat Marketing, that'll be on March the 2nd in Parsons. And so two fantastic livestock programs we have coming up, whether you're on the cow side or the sheep and goat side. So.
No, that is great. Well, it's always good to have both of you in here, James and Holly. It's just, you know, always learn so much when you guys are in. I say that every time, but it is always so true.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and I'm still impressed with that. Those outdoor wood burning things are just cool. So
it's kind of fun. You do have to fill it up. Like,
how often do you have to actually, like, stock it?
So mine's an oddly designed one.
Okay.
It's because my uncle makes these things, and so
This
one's a little bit of an experimental design, so I have to do mine twice a day. But for the most part, most of people have to fill theirs up once a day when it's decent outside, twice a day if it gets really cold out. So it is a little work, but it's not terrible by any means.
See, I was saying, it's your good winter exercise, because you can't sometimes get out, and makes you get out there and you know, work for
I have that same
satisfying
heating system in my house.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so
they got on the country when you moved, and now you have
it
one.
Has a brand name, but
yep.
So it's not an experimental design, but it's checked in the morning and in the evening just to make sure that it's good to go. And I can set my thermostat on 80 degrees and have it 80 degrees in my house all the time. It doesn't cost any more than
that's
it does.
That's what's nice about it. So last year, I mean, because we were trying to heat the house with the fireplace, some of the electric heat, we've kept the house so cold.
Yeah.
And now, if you just do it, crank it up however you want. Yep.
You know, people don't realize electricity is about the least cost-effective way you can heat your home. It's terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
It's awful.
Like, there were months last year when it was like $450 a month or something like that. Because when it gets really cold, your heat pump doesn't work very well.
Oh, no.
And so, yeah. Yeah, if you want to, if you have a place to do it.
And it, there's just nothing like the smell of wood burning.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the good thing is here in Southeast Kansas, you know, there's plenty of wood around for that, you know, compared with, you know, something like Western Kansas might not be as easy, but out here, yeah, definitely a really good source of fuel. So, alrighty. Well, I thank you guys so much for coming in as always, and I'll look forward to chatting again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right, and we'll be back with Early Bird Edition of Open Line here on KGGF.